Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
George Marcus, at the University of California, Irvine,
and George.
for
It's
about 20
wonderful.
years.
For 20 years, it's wonderful to see you after many years, and I really appreciate your doing this. We've just had a little gossip off air. And you've told me that you're a veteran of real podcasting, proper professional, pure podcasting, none of this artisanal conversational crap. So you said, I'm not setting you up to be as good as this guy, Toby, but of course, there's now a little voice in my head telling me no linguistic fillers, Mr. Miller. So it's really great to have you here. I appreciate it. And George, I wonder if we could begin by my asking you what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, worrying, interesting you? What's happening for George Marcus?
It's primarily, I guess, like everybody these days on listening to the news and the media that you now have to listen to it, I'm constantly reacting to what's happening. But if you kind of saw a kind of intellectual thread running through, it's dealing with the unending consequences of the discussions of the late 80s and 90s, during the period of, you might sort of say, the peak period of critical culture theory, where my end of it was in anthropology and the revision of the idea of ethnographic research in changing times. Of course, times have changed a lot, but I could be retired. I don't know what that would mean, but I'm not yet retired. So I deal with new students, graduate students, undergraduates to anthropology every year. And I can't say that I'm, my thinking is focused there, but it definitely affects it when I continually try to present the things I, in a kind of interior, small group way, think about to students these days, and whether it makes any sense at all. And I must say that there's a constant prod for a kind of not get with it, but a kind of renewal. Anyhow, my main vehicle for doing that at the University of California was I set up a center for ethnography when I arrived in 2005. And that was a vehicle. I knew nothing about much about California or the University of California, Irvine, but that was a vehicle to do new thinking or continued thinking from the 1980s and 90s, the era of critical cultural theory, anthropology, and in my case, identified emblematically with the production of the Writing Culture book, edited with Jim Clifford, and Anthropology as Cultural Critique with Michael Fisher, based at Rice. Which I at Rice University, which was a very close-knit, almost I think back on it idealistically, although at the time I wouldn't have going through it, but it was an ideal kind of unit for those years. I'm sure there were others elsewhere. Humanities institutes were everywhere, et cetera. Of course, this had all disappeared in the early 2000s, and the final kind of moment of change in universities and most other institutions were the consequences of the world economic crisis in 2010, 11. So these are kind of markers. And then the most recent, of course, was the pandemic. But in term, developmental terms, this is the span that I'm kind of interested in reflecting on. And my story is one of sustaining interest, even though despite, immense changes in the kind of re their representation as the framework for thinking about anything these days. Trying not to do it too conservatively, but it's a dealing with the continuities of this critical period. And I never gave up on the idea of critique. I always had close colleagues who, given their intellectual backgrounds, were more invested in the idea of critique theoretically than I was, but they immense impact on me. So even though my conversations have been less with people like, well, Steve Tyler's now deceased. Michael Fisher, I talk to very rarely, but I do follow his work. And these are kind of ingrained stalking horses for me, but this is still not bread and butter that I'm talking. But yeah, and so the associations that I made in those 20 years remain despite encouragements to move on or things are different now, remain orientations. And they're personal. They're not so much like I've stayed, even though he's gone now, I stayed with Latour. I never was with Latour or any of the notable figures of this era, but through personal relationships, intellectually speaking. And I'm also, because I have not retired, I have not, thrown my fate to the winds for my last act. I guess I'm still, captured by, even though I know better, I'm not a fervent, follower of a kind of disciplinary framework. Why bother with ethnography anymore? People write beautiful books on things that deeply concern them. But they're not building a body of knowledge that's not kind of shared with humans. They're not building a it's not like the next step in an enclosed science that's operating. I mean, I just view it that way myself. For me, I mean, I've been identified with whatever I've been thinking with anthropology or working against or, in tussle with the way anthropology imposes itself on people who want to become anthropologists. And, I don't have a retired view of it, nostalgic and all that stuff. And I, as an active person doing it, still involved with it, it's anyhow, I don't want to go on too much longer in this because I probably made the point. I'm kind of remaking what was strongest for me in those 20 years. And I don't find that hard to do. That's what I wanted to say. I don't find myself doubting myself, repeating myself, things like this, because most of the things that were proposed in the last 20 years of the 20th century were totally evoked and unfulfilled. And I'm interested in looking around, see who's doing what, how it relates to the ideals, the inquiry ideals of that period. But for me, it remains, unfinished work. Now, the question of whether it leads to, engagement in the present, book writing, caring about what's going on here or there as we now receive it through, media of universal sorts. That's I operate with uncertainty, I mean, so my ability to join with others has been this too abstract in some way. My ability to other than the ways I've created for myself here and networks of people I know, my ability to sort, and I'm getting older and all that stuff, but my ability to sort of attach whatever I value from, let's say, the fin de siècle, to the developments now have become, yeah, it's tough. Could be everybody tells you, it's technological. I'm not anti-Luddite technology, but I just my all my body patterns for I never learned to type, so I go like this. Everybody else doesn't know how to write, they type. I mean, it's these tech personal technologies of the body that really. And some, and you have to make, this is what, don't learn another language, train yourself to, love the machine or love, the technology. You have to be immersed in anyhow. So blah, 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 blah. But I'm saying that I haven't met those challenges. So I very much am a person of my, earlier times trying to deal with these times, and it's highly variable. The project of ethnography provides, continues to provide a good, what do you cover, a good thing that continues on. I'm rambling on. I have, what my, when I came to Irvine, I established the Center for Ethnography. Ethnography at that point, let's say the early 20th century, the early 21st century, first decade, ethnography was still was very hot in terms of at least here at Irvine, informatics people were interested in it, business people were interested in it. I wasn't necessarily interested in them, but the idea that the environment was such that something as peculiar as ethnography was understood and to some degree admired. Helped a lot in thinking of new things, experiments to, as an experimental space. And of course, as an experimental space, it was so that wasn't media oriented, although we've had very good students doing that kind of thing and, games, this kind of thing. And I follow it, running behind. But terms of the ethnography, person to person, Geertzian, Chicago of my era, I found like the first 20 years here, 20 years, first 15 years here, very productive in that regard. And then I think in terms of the field I operate in, anthropology, et cetera, it slipped, and other things emerged, which I'm not as close to, but I follow. I guess that's what's called, generation transition. But it was, yeah. So I had a vehicle, a form with lots of historic prestige in which to try to continue to understand the world with which I had a special association. So this was an immense advantage in creating a platform for myself. I now feel it kind of in student populations and stuff. I mean, even that I haven't kept up as well with what's going on in the way that people who like I share perspectives with, like Michael Fisher or actually former students here at Irvine. There are about five students in our department here who were products of rice during that very important period when the rice department was a node in the, international network, a small node, in of cultural, critical cultural thinking. And so we have four or five students here, and they've done, very interesting stuff, but I'm very grateful for it because they let me, they're like real-time human measures of where I am and not. And so, it's not that I'm trying to keep up. It's just that I have a way mark. I know where I am. And yeah, so very much, I have to say, very much in a very, I keep myself up by kind of measuring myself against those who are still alive, measuring myself in relation to, not competitive, but just knowing, do I understand what they're doing now, that kind of thing. Anyhow, this is a very generic way of thinking about it, but I think it has to be. I think every specific thing that maybe this is just getting old, period, or reflective in that way, that every specific thing that you're interested in, when it wears out, it's out. And it doesn't necessarily lead to the next thing. But if you stay interested in what people you were working with are do the range of things that they're doing, that tends to be open-ended in a way. Like what the key word was ethnography and design. Ethnography Alliance with Design for the Center for Ethnography here from about 2004 to about 2010. And there was great enthusiasm for it. I have a colleague here, Keith Murphy, with whom we ran a little, not a center, but workshops. What we created were something called ethno charrettes. And these were kind of events in constructing things from kind of design principles and methods of creativity and try and put together or change projects. And mainly we were dealing with students. And at that time, as I think I mentioned, there was a lot of interest in ethnography from informatics, from the arts. And it was a very alive moment. For some reason, it ended, not ended like prunk, and this is not worth anything, but the vitality of it, as of a lot of other things of our era, went out after the 2011, 10, 11 economic crisis, when there was a lot of cutbacks and sober thinking. And now things have come back in a variety of ways, but it was a definite break. The whole here at Irvine, which was a one of the attractions, was was where the French came to do their thing, and Derrida was on the faculty here. There was one remaining French professor. Other people. Anyhow, it was noted for that. People would come to Irvine for these conferences. Critical theory was a major program. After 2011, I'm not saying everyone went down the tubes, but that sort of organic, the Critical Theory Institute, which I joined in its late stage when I came here, which people were, it was not a favorite on campus because they elected people to be part of it and excluded a lot of very good people, but there are like 12 people who pursued a topic and produced a book every year, and it was kind of famous for a while. But that suddenly, boom, ended, and the connection of critical theory, which had been very strong here, to everything else that it influenced, collapsed. And so those of us who were involved in, you might say, cultural studies of the 80s, 90s, it was a fundamental shift. And people went back into their departments, and cultural studies here became comp lit, and people had their usual academic agreements and disagreements. So what was special here was kind of a lot. Balibar, who was the last Frenchman, left. He went to Columbia, and I must say, just him being here was just a kind of major symbolic importance. Gayatri Spivak used to be here, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, not full time, but visiting these efforts here. Anyhow, so that all ended after around 2010, 2011. And in terms of my own thinking and writing, as always, I didn't feel I was at the heart of it. So its passing, I definitely registered. It definitely influenced the kinds of conversations that you could have here on a regular basis, not based on, and yeah, it changed things. It changed the nature of our department, Anthro, which was very much oriented toward critical cultural theory, etc. Anyhow, I don't know. I'm totally rambling on. But my constant was the Center for Ethnography and tried to keep it going. And yeah.
And you mentioned the books with Michael and Jim from the 80s and 90s. Anthropology as Cultural Critique had a second edition, of
Yeah.
course. And those books were enormously influential with people like me and those around us. And you talk about some concepts coming and going. I have this search for single words that come and go. In the 80s, lots and lots of conferences of different kinds had lots and lots of papers with the title postmodern, the word postmodern in the title.
Oh, yeah.
In the 1990s and the early 2000s, lots of conference papers had the word globalization in the title.
Oh, yeah.
And now they have the word decolonial in the title, or some variation of those words. And I think all of those concepts, even if they weren't uttered as such, were very important in your work, both your work with Michael and Jim, but on your own. And I wanted to ask you about a particular essay, one of two essays that changed the way I saw the world.
Oh,
First of these, quarter of a century earlier, was Laura Nader studying up, which our mutual friend Faye Ginsburg turned me on to many years ago. That really
wow.
changed the way I saw things. And not long after I read that, out came your essay in the mid-90s on multi-sited ethnography.
Oh, yeah.
And whilst I think anthropology is cultural critique and writing culture will stand forever, I think they'll be read forever, to the extent there is a forever.
You mean forever as long as we live?
As long as this podcast episode remains available, George.
Yeah.
I think that at a methodological level, at a conceptual level, some of the things you did in multi-sited ethnography and have incarnated since in your work and that of others is immensely important. So I wonder if you could reflect a bit on the multi-sited ethnography efforts. This may be a term that's gobbledygook to some listeners, but it may be very clear to others. So I wondered if you could tell us, like, what the heck is multi-sited ethnography?
Oh
I mean, no one's ever
no.
asked that question before, George.
Well, huh?
No one's
To
ever asked that question before.
totally. Oh, okay. Everything all right? Yeah.
Yes, I'm just getting myself a drink. It's,
Oh, please.
it's 8 o'clock here in
I
Madrid.
hope it's a good one, like sherry or something. I don't know.
It's a Roble, and if you
Oh.
buy it at the corner store, it's $5, and if you buy it at the cheese shop, it's 19.
Oh. By the way, I got a hold of that query, but are you in Spain now as a for life?
I don't know. I have a contract until the end of August, and but I've been a multi-sited professor for some years, George. I don't have, in inverted commas, a proper job.
But
So
years ago, you were here in California.
Yeah, I was at UC Riverside
That's right.
until 2014, and we would have last seen one another at Irvine, I think. And I went and I moved to London, and my job there didn't work out. I lost it, as did some other people. And since then, I've gone where I can get work. So I've been in Barranquilla and Cartagena de Indias in Colombia. I've been in Mexico
Wow.
City, I've been in New Orleans, and now I'm in Madrid. So, yeah.
Very exciting. I've
Yeah.
just been what do you call it in the British system when you're a retiree and you get a you sit around comfortably and pensioner or something. Not yet, but I've felt like a pensioner for about 10 years now. Anyway, no, I'm just kidding. The multi-sided thing was totally unexpected and opportunistic, but obviously I was capable of articulating it in a very plain Jane form, which a lot of people read, which was the Annual Reviews of Anthropology. I had written one other piece for the Annual Review of Anthropology, which also very early on had a lot of impact. It was Ethnographies as Text in around 1990, as a result of having to teach in a course on classic ethnographies and having a wonderful co-teacher who's now deceased, Dick Cushman. I'm often asked, who was Dick Cushman? Wonderful guy who just didn't continue on in academia. That book, that in the annual review context, that had a lot of impact, but nothing like multi-sided. Multi-site, it was a very clear explanation of a different way of doing things that could be easily assimilated. It wasn't a how-to. It was sort of, hard to say, but I was just given the assignment. Others, take the annual review assignments because they have a little bit of prestige, but generally, like they're reviewing literatures, and boom, it was just an inspiration, and it worked. And it's the piece that really communicates, right?
Yes.
So, in terms of it being more important than that, I mean, it is more important if you can dig under the, if you really followed its followings, follow this and follow that, it re really means that ethnographers would work differently. But it really expressed part of that ideology of change of the late 20th century, early, as against the debate, the object of study was globalization and neoliberalism and so forth and so on. And even though I didn't use any of that terminology, it was kind of, bedrock. Here's how you construct a study that can be multi-sided in the true spirit of ethnography. It just worked. It's one of those things that's really hard to say. And it provided a kind of target of performance that you could meet easily or more difficult, like the various simple ideas of following processes and what the implications would be for the ideology of field work. I mean, I could have written a book on that, but the book would have sort of gone the way of all books. But just writing the article in the annual review, more or less clinical, that's probably the wrong term to use, was like magic. I mean, I can't count, I other than, wow, that's great. I really can't account for it. It was really important. But remember, I was always the writing culture person who was not into literary culture. I was the one person that my chapter in writing culture deals with multi-sided ethnography and taking an exemplary work, the Paul Willis book, which has been immensely important in cultural studies. And I would say that that work. It's not elegant written in writing. It's kind of heavy in many ways, but that work is so influential, and it's multi-sided ethnography, right? The
This is
implication
learning to labor. This is learning to labor.
Learning to labor.
Yeah,
You
how
can't
working class kids
understand
get working
the
class jobs.
ethnographic,
How working class kids get working class jobs.
jobs. Yeah, you can't understand a location of intensive ethnographic interest and relationship without understanding what the implication of that setting is elsewhere. So you have to understand processes other than in structuralist terms, theoretical terms. You have to understand the processes themselves in ethnographic terms, and it requires you to do something more dynamic in field work. Now, he didn't live up to that totally, but the plan was there. I mean, the and he wasn't, he was concerned. It was kind of, it was very much a British context, but class and so forth, very important, but just in terms of what he was doing. So my piece in Writing Culture is a heavy piece because it the exercise is that, which is what I thought we were going to do with the Writing Culture book. Glad we didn't. Whereas most people, took positions and wrote about them elegantly and used examples. I thought, oh, well, each one of us would take an ethnography and work through it. It would have been far less interesting a book if people didn't put their belief and blood into it, like, at that time. But it's interesting. When we were working on it, different people had different. Like Jim Clifford was my primary partner in that, but he was the guiding force. I don't know, I'm wandering off, but it was the roots of it were in that my expression of it in that book, but in a very weighty and not very concise, and just somehow the other annual review thing worked, and it was accessible. So I think it's most quoted by, you'll forgive me, people in education or something. It had impact in that regard.
Well, I think one of the things it does is to make us realize that, a good ethnography of the 3% of the population that still form the French peasantry needs also to understand the workings of the European Union's bureaucrats, their agriculture legislation, and the way agriculture matters and doesn't in the Élysée Palace and France more generally. I mean, that's what I took it to be telling us. And the thing that was important for me was that the way I linked this to your work on elites and to Laura Nader's studying up piece from 50 years ago was that if you want to understand life at the bottom of the social structure fully, you need to understand the whole of the social structure in a
True.
dynamic way that isn't just mechanistic, as political economy can be, but allows for agency and experience and myth and so on. That's what I took from it, from my mangled
No.
linkage.
Beautiful. And also the surprising and unsuspected linkages between the top and, how that understanding exists socially. Although I don't write like Dickens as a not, for me to read, but Dickensian and a number of other, it's a primary aim of realist English fiction in the and French in the 19th century, but I don't want it to go there. I just want it to go in terms of ethnography as we knew it at the time, right? And as it was pressed out of the niches into which it was placed in the era, Cold War era of you want to study the X in the mountains? Well, attach yourself to some development project. And your research would follow the links of power, but your thing would be anthropology among the X, or a radical kind of Marxist anthropology of that period, but not really seeing the kind of connections that are really there if you pay close attention to the ethnography. And so, yeah, and so I was trying to establish awareness of how, frankly, in the discipline of anthropology, which I've always been concerned a lot about how people get into the field. In other words, many people go through very interesting multi-sided processes to wind up, in the jungles of X or in Brazil or something like that. And then they recontextualize themselves in terms of the debates of the day, but they don't see their own work dynamically encompassing the networks, the processual movement. And in the end, also focusing on what it is that anthropology teaches you to focus on, a situated population. Struggling with life. So it had that advantage too. A lot of stuff, rhetoric provided perspective in anthropology, how you locate the particular in the whole, in the total. And a lot of it was rhetoric, I would say. Or there was no room in anthropological thinking as such, which emphasized ethnography for including this processual context. Lots of, what do you call it, theory or rhetoric for doing so, but nothing that included it in the space of the ethnography. Of course, there were migration and blah, 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 but these were the obvious things. So the multi-sided piece was pushing for non-obvious. And in the end, the more I try for the more imaginative, following a process, okay? But I also said following a process as a story, or following a process as a piece of national fiction. There I was getting into the idea of ethnographic documentation merged with other kind of genres of representation. I mean, that was the implication. You want to do that? You better look into film. How film move, social realist film or whatever, connects space and time. And then the idea is, okay, you're not going to become necessarily a filmmaker, but you're going to, which is not a bad idea either. I guess, I don't know. But you're going to, the scope of the ethnography is somehow going to be, influenced by those other ways of narrating things. And I think there was a lot of what do you call it, ideology in this direction, but nothing that got to the bare bones of doing it. And that the multi-sided piece was a doing it kind of piece.
And as you say, its location in the Annual Review of Anthropology was important because those annual reviews, and I read the ones in anthropology, sociology, and political science, are terrific if you're a bit of an outsider because they take you, this is all the stuff that we've been thinking. They're very plural in a good sense. The best of them, in addition to being plural, have a point to make, which you had. And that leads me on to asking you about one of the things that you've done that isn't so much about the classic anthropological voyage in search of the people of X, X being part of the global South. you're interested in, or you have, in addition to doing that sort of work, you've also done work on the people who are among us and yet not. People that Hemingway and Fitzgerald, sorry, the podcat Chinguri is making his.
Oh, I
People
love
that Hemingway and Fitzgerald fought over, they're like us, they just have more money.
it. More money. Well, I have to say that I mean, how frank could I be? I never became those who hope for a lot from me or more from me, like in graduate school, you have to pick a place to go. And I didn't have a natural place to go. I was at Harvard. I didn't want to go to the Chiapas Project, or I love Brazil, but the Brazilian Project. So there was a young, ambitious guy said, "Oh, come and join my project in Fiji." But there's this outlier, this kingdom that needs to be studied. And I sort of didn't like Cambridge, I didn't like Harvard, I didn't like graduate school. I wasn't miserable, but I just think, oh my God. And so I said, okay, I'll do the study, just me. I'll go and do the study in Tonga. And I did it. I saw very clearly that this was an opportunity to study rank and elites and blah, 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 blah. So that's what I w did in Tonga. Very few people know of that work, right? I mean, there are a couple of pieces that I wrote that I'm very proud of, but I won't tell you about this because it'll take us, blah, blah, blah. But otherwise, I came back, but do I want to be a part, like Marshall Solon's light? Do I want to, first of all, I went to there was an association for oceanic studies. And some of the brightest young anthropologists from Chicago and all these other places were doing, it was the last great period in the 1970s to work in places like New Guinea and stuff. And you don't pay as much. Those are such wonderfully weird places that you don't pay that much attention to the colonial context. You really are in there. And in some ways, you could do it in Africa and certain places in Asia and others, but it was the last kind of region of the world that was not important, quote unquote, and but that was anthropologically extremely important and interesting. That was a great beginning, and that's where I developed my Tongan work. But I couldn't, I had to develop. So I wasn't really a deeply committed Polynesianist, but in the realm of how you made anthropology in that time, that's how you made anthropology. You worked in certain areas of the world, you were devoted to these areas, languages, etc. And I was a visitor in some ways. So, but I was very interested in elite studies, and I shifted it back to a very interesting project near me in Texas on an old elite that dominated Galveston, Texas. And there was wonderful material there. And it connected to the Tongan way in which anthropologists crudely, how are the Tongans like, the US, like Trump, that kind of thing. And okay. So I hope I'm getting to the interesting part of this, but it might be, roundabout. So that got me into it, and then I saw through the network of what these Galveston people were part of, and really the late 20th century was the playing out of the great wave of wealth that was created in the 19th century, late 19th century, in the United States. And the people that I was concerned about were the people who created the structures to preserve their wealth. I mean, most people can preserve their wealth by having good advisors and bankers, et cetera. But these people owned institutions that perpetuated them. So it would just became a, and there were variations. There was an old Jewish family that did this, an old, Southern family, and it was just wonderful material. And then I met up with people who were doing this work at that time, particularly in philanthropic stuff. It was a very alive period, not in anthropology, but in scholarship. And I got caught up in it. And that's how I did that work. And then I promoted the anthropology of elites a bit in anthropology. And everybody says, like Lauren Ader studying, good on you, good. Yeah, we should do more of that. Oh yeah, anthropology of elites studying up. That's the way we learn the secrets of wealth. The whole history of the anthropological study of studying up would be an interesting way to approach an aspect of the history of anthropology. Yes, we should do that too, but we're of the people, that kind of thing. So they weren't very welcoming, but others were, sociologists, economists. I mean, it opened a lot of doors into interesting stuff that I followed in a zigzag way. So it was a fascinating kind of thing. Now, for a long time after, dealing with writing culture and being involved in the form of the ethnography and stuff, it comes back to me. This book that I wrote in 1982, not much recognized in anthropology, was greatly admired by rich people. By subjects, and I only slowly came to learn of this. So this guy who managed, he lives in Aspen, and he managed rich people's wealth forever in the characteristic way, now wants to own me, own my intellectual stuff, and I've been, it's tr tricky. It's like the 19th century and, what's his name?
Carnegie.
Huh? Well, the novels of Elizabeth. Anyhow, it's sort of like you get co-opted. Anyhow, the long and the short of it is he went to this dead, find the publisher, Westview, I think, of this dead book. Dead, except to this group. If you look it up, there's some say, oh, this helped my family. It's a great book, et cetera. Amazon or whatever it is, which reviews books. And then he sort of bought the book. I mean, when they buy and take over property, they know what they're doing. He bought the guy who advised wealth for generations now has his foundation. And he bought my book, Hook, Line, and Sinker. I just came along. He sent me a check, this guy. Now what I'm doing is I'm rewriting it for his reissuance of it. I'm not rewriting it a lot because I have other interests, but I'm doctoring that book for contemporary interests that he has.
I love it.
It's amazing. I've been co-opted. My intellectual product has been.
Yeah.
That's happened twice. Also, I did a project in Portugal on one of the last very active Portuguese nobles. And I wrote a book of dialogue between us, 160 letters in anticipation of a ethnographic project whose final conference would be in his palace in Lisbon. And that all happened. But he threw me away after he finished playing with this idea. But the sort of romance, the pastoral of it all is right in this book of conversations. I called it Crucial. That was a mistake. Because that's the, I'm going on with this. But anyhow, my work on elites went in that direction. And now it's woven back. Because I spent a year, one of the first years at the Getty, it went, I was going to do something on the Getty, but I got very deeply into art collections, rich people in art collections. Back in, and Fred Myers and I did a book on anthropology and art.
The Traffic
So,
in Culture, a wonderful book
yeah.
by you and our mutual friend Fred.
And Fred has, kept up. I mean, he's an advisor to people who want to buy the Australian stuff he powered. So there are many more interesting stories, but this has been my twist.
Well, George, I want
I'm
to thank
sorry that I wandered.
No, you. That's multi-sensory ethnography, buddy. It involves
Huh?
wandering, wandering and wondering. No, I want to thank you, Prof, for decades of brilliant insight and writing, which has had an influence on probably hundreds of thousands of us, if not more, some of whom are slightly more important than others, per by your intellectual property. I want to thank you for that, but also for your generosity in our conversation of today. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you, Toby. You've been very kind to me.